We are in 1 Samuel chapter 23. As we continue our endeavor with David as he tries to flee Saul and try to figure out how to what he does with his life. You know, funny, we all seem to have that at one point or another. We discuss and see how other people treated him. Some good, some not so good. He, of course, as he always does, seems to write a song about it, which is also Psalm 54, in case you're curious. It's relatively short. Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, God, we thank you. We thank you for our Shabbats. We thank you for our time which we get to worship you and learn about you. God, please keep our hearts and eyes and ears open to you, open to your word, to your guidance, how we may apply your guidance in our own lives. God, we thank you and praise you for giving us these wonderful history lessons and stories about what your people have done, good and bad. We may learn from them. Please continue to bless us and teach us. In the name of your son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.
David was told, the Plishtim are fighting Keilah and plundering the threshing floors. David consulted Yahweh, asking, should I go and attack these Philistines? Yahweh answered David, go and attack the Plishtim and save Keilah. David's men said to him, look, we're already afraid here in Yehuda. How much more then if we go to Keilah to fight the armies of the Philistine? David consulted Yahweh again, and Yahweh answered him, set out and go down to Keilah, because I will hand the Philistine over to you. David and his men went to Keilah and fought the Philistine. They defeated them in a great slaughter and led away their livestock. Thus David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. When Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David in Keilah, he had brought a ritual vest with him. Now Shaul, on being informed that David had gone to Keilah, had said, God has put him into my hands. He's trapped himself by entering a town with gates and bars. So Shaul summoned all the people to war to go down to Keilah and besiege David and his men. David knew that Shaul was plotting something against him. So he told Abiathar the Kohen, bring the ritual vest here. Then David said, Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Shaul intends to come to Keilah and destroy the city just to get me. Will the men of Keilah turn me over to him? Will Shaul come down as your servant has heard? Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, please tell your servant. Yahweh said, he will come down. Then David asked, will the men of Keilah hand me over, my men over to Shaul? Yahweh said, they will hand you over. So David and his men, now around 600, got up, left Keilah, and went wherever they could. It was told Shaul that David had escaped from Keilah, so he called off the expedition. David stayed in the desert strongholds, remaining in the hills of the Ziph desert. Shaul kept trying to find him, but God did not hand him over to him. David saw that Shaul had mounted another expedition to seek his life. David was then at Horesh in the Ziph desert. Jehonatan, Shaul's son, set out and went to David at Horesh to encourage him in God. He said to him, don't be afraid, because my father's forces will not find you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Shaul, my father, knows this too. Then the two of them made a covenant in the presence of Yahweh, after which David stayed at Horesh, and Jehonatan returned home. The people of Ziph came to Shaul in Gibeah and said, David is hiding himself with us in the strongholds at Horesh on Hachilah Hill, south of Yeshimon. So now, king, since you've wanted so much to come down, come down. Our part will be to turn him over to you. Shaul said, may Yahweh bless you for showing me compassion. Please go and make still more certain exactly where he is and who has seen him there, because I've told I've been told that he's very tricky. So look closely, find out where all his hiding places are, and come back when you're sure. Then I will go with you. And if he is there in that territory, I'll search till I find him among all the thousands of Yehuda. They set out and went to Ziph before Shaul. But David and his men had gone on to the Maon desert in the Arava, south of Yeshimon. Shaul and his men went searching for him. David was told, so he came down to the rock and stayed in the Maon desert. When Shaul heard it, he pursued David in the Maon desert. Shaul went along one side of the mountain, while David and his men went along the other. David was hurrying to get away from Shaul, while Shaul and his men were trying to surround David and his men in order to capture them. But then a messenger came to Shaul, saying, "Hurry, come, because the Philistines are invading the country." So Shaul stopped chasing David and went to fight the Philistine. Therefore they called that place Sela Hamachalechat, Rock of Divisions.
Thank you. This is an interesting part of the chapters. Before I get into 1 Samuel 23, are there any comments or questions, things that caught your attention that you have an answer or would like an answer for? Assuming, of course, I have an answer for you. Yes, Anne.
Isn't there a verse 29, and David went up from thence and dwelt in strongholds at En-Gedi?
That should be in your first verse of chapter 24. I shouldn't say it should be. In some translations, that's verse 1 of chapter 24. Others, it's verse, the last one, verse 29, whatever it is, 30 of chapter 23. Whether it's one or the other, it's debatable which version you happen to own. We'll be going that next time, 2 weeks from now. Yes, Hank.
Is that the priestly ephod he's picking up?
Yes, that would be verse 6, Abiathar. Those of you recall, there's an ephod that is associated with the priesthood, and of course it has, Urim and the Thummim in it, the breastplate, a few of the things that are components that are associated with it. These things are used to talk to God. It's how you communicate with God. How you ask questions and get direct answers. I don't know how many of you have asked God a question. Does he come down and give you the answer? Not usually. If you were part of the priesthood and you had an ephod, would he come down and give you an answer? Well, yes, that's what he always did. So what would make him change? Well, it wouldn't. That's his task. And of course, you have to be somebody important, not just any old schmuck. Yes.
I didn't catch that. Did you just mention the Urim and the...
Yeah, inside the breastplate attached to the ephod.
Okay.
Yes. That's how the priesthood asks questions. It's still up to God whether he chooses to answer those questions. Because depending on who's asking dictates what he's going to answer. Saul ends up asking a few questions, and unfortunately God says nothing. Doesn't matter, because God's not going to answer Saul's questions. You have to be somebody of worth something to him. You have something to offer God. Are you a righteous individual? Are you doing what I want you to do? Are you doing something completely contrary to my word? Have you done some horrible evil act that I cannot speak to you? Well, that kind of isolates between Saul and David what the two of them have done. So it's not like God is obligated to answer your question. He's just more likely to do it if you have an ephod with an Urim and Thummim in it. Any questions or comments? Yes, Joshua.
And about, you said, if you're righteous, or to me, if you have an obedient heart, because Saul kind of showed a little bit of different wishy-washy or whatever.
Right.
But also, I'm just reminded, the verse says, "My sheep hear my voice." Maybe through his word, there's a lot of different ways. So
that is true, and that's what's used today. Now, keep in mind that if you've noticed, we're in 1 Samuel 23, so 2 Samuel, the Chronicles, another prophet, none of those things have even existed or been written yet. Well, there's not much voice to hear if there's nothing there written down yet. So until those things are completed, you're certainly welcome to talk to God. That's how he gets his information in his book. Else there's nothing there. It's an empty book that stops in 1 Samuel. So these, of course, as I mentioned before, it depends on the individual who's asking. The Urim and Thummim were discussed, or we talked about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, that it's used by leadership only, usually it was either king, high priest, or a judge. Those are three individuals who could ask. Now, of course, who'd the king have to be? An anointed one of God. Who'd the high priest have to be? The anointed one of God. Who'd the judge have to be? The selected, usually anointed, one of God. I am neither of those. If it was in front of me, would I be able to ask the questions and assume I would get an answer? By no means would I ever get an answer. Only certain individuals were allowed to ask God questions. And it was associated with their future. Temporary future, not, you know, oh, what my great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren do. Who cares? What am I going to do? What's my date for today? What is it tomorrow? That's what you are asking. It's an immediate need, not a want. Any other questions or comments? All right, well, go ahead and get into this. So David hears the Philistines, of course, battle Elah. Now, of course, my little map is up here. It shows the what is supposed to be the Dead Sea, this little black circle blob thing there. Philistines is a little space over here. And, of course, I have for reference Jerusalem approximately where it's located. My maps aren't perfect, so bear with me. Keilah is, they call it a border town, but it's not really that close to the border. It's relatively close. There are a number of Judah's cities that are between Keilah and the Philistine territory, but because the Philistine territory kept moving, it becomes a border town one day, and it's not a border town the next day. It depends on how those battle lines get drawn and how the invaders come. So it is a walled city. It's obviously in Judah's territory. I also have Ziph, of course, which is where David eventually goes to, and of course, in Gedi, which we go to the next chapter, where he travels. These are David's and his men's stomping ground. This is the area which they're accustomed to living. They know the people here. They know the cities, they know the towns, they know the individuals, they have their families in and around this area. They know it. What better person would there ever be to go fight a battle if one who, rather than one who knows the terrain? Well, they know it very, very well. So Keilah, the men would say, well, we don't really want to go here. Well, because they know what's there. They know they would be very exposed. Because Keilah is a walled city, as they mentioned in the Bible already. And Saul will, of course, then find out where they're at. But they've been hiding all along. They don't want Saul to find out. So they're hesitant to go, in spite of the fact that that's David's job. You see, David is a unique character, unique person. Just because he fell out of favor with Saul doesn't mean he forgot his tasks. His task was still to defend Israel. He still obeyed what God assigned to him. You must defend these people. You must defend your land. Whatever's going on between you and Saul, it doesn't matter. Your job is still to do your job. So David said, oh, look, there was an opportunity for me to go do my job again. God, should I go do this? Or should I continue my fleeing? I said, no, go ahead, go. That's your task. Go do it. That's what he was assigned to when he was working for Saul. To go raid the Philistines. To go defend the cities with his hundreds or thousands of men that were with him. David's men, however, at this point, have no such obligation. They were not military men. Granted, they're learning, but they weren't when they started with. As I mentioned in the previous chapter, all the dregs of society gathered to David. The people who had a gripe against the government. The people who had debts. The people that nobody wanted. Their families rejected them. Are these military men? Of course not. Some probably have some military experience. Even David's own brothers were with him, at least a few of them. But they were not military experienced men such as the warriors in Saul's army. So do they have an obligation to go to Keilah? Unless they have a family there, no. There's nothing there for them. No reason to go defend some town. They're busy running away. So of course they are hesitant to go. And David inquires of God because he has the ephod there. He has the Urim and Thummim there. He can ask. And of course, Abiathar is the one who has to physically go forth and ask God, not David himself. One thing that David is a little bit concerned with is, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Well, after he gets to Keilah. All right. Verse 6, of course, I already mentioned Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech. And I mentioned 2 weeks ago, there's no evidence that Ahimelech is the younger brother of Zadok. He could be the older brother, meaning he could have been the high priest that Saul had slaughtered. I personally have chosen to try to paint Saul in a better light, though black light just doesn't look so good anyway, no matter how you look at it. That he was not quite the high priest, but there's an extremely high probability that he, in fact, was. But I do want to point out, last time, as I point out, that the location of the city of Nob, which where the priest was, closer to Shiloh, well, there's actually two locations. They're not sure which one it was. The location, city of Nob, is one up close to Shiloh, which would be consistent with the destruction of the city and town of Shiloh. All the stuff would go to the next closest town, which was Nob. And there was a city up there of similar spelling. There was also a second city right next to Jerusalem with similar spelling. Which one it is, we don't actually know. I just gave the assumption that it would make sense for it to be near Shiloh where all the stuff was. But I could have been wrong. In fact, Nob could be right next to Jerusalem, the alternative location. Just, it's a tidbit of information. The reason I bring it up is because it would be located where would it be located? You could throw a stone from Jerusalem's border and hit it. If you're really good arm. Northeast. Yeah, that sounds familiar. What are the towns there? That's too far away. We're talking super, super close. Like, literally, throw a rock and hit it. No, Bethlehem's further south. What's south? What's next to Jerusalem? City of David. So it could, in fact, be that that was where he chose to put his dwelling place. Where Nob was, where those high priests were. Equally legitimate as it could have been the one next to Shiloh, which is where the high priests were located at. But just to point out, it's possible one or the other. I just want to put it in there because it is a possible difference. So, Abiathar, of course, flees Nob and, of course, travels with David, and they end up with Keilah, or end up in that town. He brings the ephod with him. Now, the ephod contains a breastplate, right? The breastplate contains the Urim and the Thummim. Is Abiathar, is he the only one who has it? See, this is an interesting point. There is nothing in the Torah that says you cannot make more than one of an ephod, a breastplate, or an Urim and Thummim. There is nothing that condemns it. The ark, yes. You cannot make a second ark, period. But the priestly garments? Well, of course you can. What happens when one gets contaminated? You sure better have a spare right there next to you. If one gets damaged, you better have a spare right next to you. So does he have the one and only? No, actually, we already know he does not. He has one, but not the one and only. Yes, Hank.
Well, the ephod was like Gideon's flag after he put
yes,
an ephod everywhere.
Yeah, Gideon had an ephod on his flag, yeah. as his flag too. Clearly, he's not the only one who had one. So Abiathar, who brings the ephod with a breastplate and with an Urim and Thummim, brings it to David. Saul, we find out a couple chapters from now, still has one in his possession too. But when Saul asks, it doesn't give him an answer. When David asks, it gives him an answer. But there's more than one. Yes, Anne.
Am I confused because there's like the ephod where you could take the grain and put it in the ephod, or is that a different word?
Ephod, not ephod. It's different spelling. The measuring versus ephod, with a D at the end of it, is a garment. It's a priestly garment. The garments that the priests wore, a high priest would wear. They have a breastplate which has all the various stones on it. It has two other stones have all the names, the tribes of Israel on it. It's got gold cord braids, and it has an Urim and Thummim tucked inside the breastplate. It's a garment which you would wear when you come before God to do anything. whether to sacrifice, whether the case of the high priest would wear it, not just anybody. The high priest. It's a unit of measure. It's a measure of grain. It's two different words. Yeah, exactly. You treat it like you would a bushel as the ephah. Yeah, yes, that's the distinction. Yeah. So, David has one with him, but Saul still has one too. Keep that in mind. There is more than just one. And is he the only people who have one? Just these two? No. Well, what do you mean no? How do I know that? Well, recall back with Micah. Micah and the grandson of Moses, Jonathan. When Jonathan comes forth and tells the tribe of Dan, yeah, you can go up north, and what does Jonathan do? Well, he takes a duplicate, or he makes a duplicate of the exact southern priesthood, and brings up to Dan, and says, this is now, I will be your priests. He has an ephah with him, he has various other components with him. Created ones, they're created by man, they've been duplicated after the original one that Moses had, but they're still duplicates. So there's at least a third one we know of. And of course, we're talking about the Gideons who had a fourth one. Not quite sure what it looked like. So there's more than one or two or three out there. There's actually a number of them. All used by the leadership of priesthood. Which one would God answer through? Well, the one he chooses. Yes.
Lions.
Yeah.
It sounds like God was answering through, you know, David or through Abiathar.
The way it's worded, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's his intention. You know, when he does structure something, it's not like, okay, hand them out, boys, and I'll answer every Tom, Dick, and Harry. You know what I'm saying? I don't know
you're
if that's his
right.
Heart.
It wasn't exactly. Not every Tom, Dick, and Harry got an answer. Anne, yes, your question.
Some people may think, well, I'll just get a Ouija board, and God can answer me through the Ouija board. After all, he's answering through this breastplate here, and...
Well, last I checked, Ouija board, fortunately, is not a breastplate. but no, you're right. You can have this whole concept of a magic charm object. Oh, look, see, this object will save me. This object I can talk to gods or the spirits or whatever through. Well, and right, that can mess you up pretty quickly. Now, who everybody else is talking to, assuming they are receiving answers, I can't vouch for. All we know is that God talks to David at this point. And he's talking to him, and he's using that ephah to do it. Because until David had it, he never asked God a question. I mean, throughout the history of David, up to this point, is there any question, God, should I do X, should I do Y? He never asks why. Number one, he's not king. Yes, he was anointed, but he's not actually taken the throne. He's not king, so he can't legally ask. He's not judge of Israel yet, so he can't legally ask. He's no high priest. He knows better than to ask until he gets one.
Casting of lots back then when David, or was that...
No,
I don't know if David's
not described that he actually used one, but yes, casting of lots would have done so. But all that's going to identify as who does what, or who does it, not should I do, or should it be done. There's no way of asking the should when you're casting lots. Okay, continue on a little bit. So just so you're aware, so the ephod is commonly used. Jeff, you had your hand up a minute ago. I didn't.
I was just saying, you know, it's kind of like a phone. You know, you could dial a number, but the person doesn't have to pick up.
Could be busy. Busy talking to somebody else. Okay, so yes, David gets responses. Saul does not. We'll read that when we get to Saul, when he has to ask God a question and gets nothing. All right, so David and his men, they travel down. And verse 7. Saul was told that David had come to Keilah, and Saul said, God has delivered him into my hand, for he's been trapped by coming into a city of gates and bar. It appears that Saul still believes that God's on his side, doesn't it? Saul wouldn't say, oh look, God blessed me. Unless he believed that God was still on his side. In spite of the fact that he just slaughtered the entire priesthood of the city of Nob. In spite of the fact he's been told by Samuel that his kingship will be ripped out from underneath him. In spite of the fact that He knows full well that David is going to be that new king, or soon will know full well that David will be that king. Still believes that he's obeying and doing what is right. Do Saul's men think that? Yes, some do. Saul's general does. I think it's, I forgot his name. I'll remember it in a little while. Saul's general thinks he's doing right, but most of Saul's men, I don't believe, do, because when Saul was inquiring and accusing those high priests, see, you've helped David, you've done things against me. And he told his men, go kill them. His men looked at him, looked at them, and said, no. His men, at least one's there at that mock trial, seems to believe the priests didn't do anything wrong. But they have a dilemma. Do they obey the king, the anointed one of God, or do they not? That's a tough question. It's a tough thing to ask. Because legally they know, all right, Saul, you were selected by God. Most of us were there when it happened. We saw Samuel anoint you. We saw the various things that happened and all the various prophecies about you. We know God's with you, or at least was with you. Do I continue to obey you, as I'm supposed to? Or do I say, no, I will not, and stand essentially on my own? Not an easy thing to, not an easy thing to do. Yes, Joshua.
A similar scenario for all of us.
It is.
Soon.
Which brings the whole point of this. It's not easy. Exactly. What point do I draw the line? Yes, Bill.
Oh, it's like this Manhattan thing. If the president is assigned by God to be president, and he's allowing this stuff to go on, we're between a rock and a hard place here. What's right and who's right to do? Yeah.
It's a dilemma. When you were dealing with leaders, and leadership is going down a path that you know, or used to believe, is not godly path, do you continue on with them? Do you stand on your own and run the risk of disobeying the commandment of God? This is what we're going to get into, which is part of what David's psalm was about in verse 54, which we'll get to hopefully today. So David asks, and of course Saul's on his way, he believes God's with him. Clearly God is not, but he just thinks he is temporarily. David learns that Saul's coming against him. He goes to Abiathar and the Kohen and bring forth the ephod, he said. And of course, he asks God two questions. He says, first, Lord God, your servant has heard that Saul seeks to come. This is verse 10. He seeks to come to Keilah, destroy the city on my account. Will the inhabitants of Keilah give me over? And will Saul come down here as your servant has heard? Lord God, please say, your servant. The Lord answers, he will come down. Note, he doesn't say, yes, the inhabitants will turn you over. It's not initially. Because David made a mistake. He asked two questions of God. So which one does God say yes or no to? He answered the last one first, because it's the most recent question. It makes sense, right? You don't get to ask a whole bunch of questions. It's one at a time. God's going to deal with you one at a time. All right, just if you have a whole bunch, oh, God, should I do X, Y, or Z? Okay, so I also do A, B, and C. Hold on a minute. Let's discuss one at a time. We'll deal with one task, then when I've given you that answer, then move on to the next task. Now, the questions could be really, really close to one another, but the point is God's going to answer one at a time, not all of them at a time. Now, we look at that, well, God answers lots of our questions, lots of our problems all at once. So, that may be the case, but that's his prerogative. He's allowed to do that. But that doesn't mean he's going to do that all the time to everybody. So David asks two questions. God answers the last one. It's the most recent one. First, yes, Saul's going to come down. So David has to re-ask. Okay, are the inhabitants of Keilah going to turn me over? Yes or no? Yes, they'll turn you over. God probably could have found another way of doing it. Could have said yes to both, but he didn't. This is how he worked. As a result, there seems to be rules written, which I don't know where they get them all from, about how you're allowed to ask and talk to the ephod. Now written in Judaism. There are now rules. You are not allowed to ask more than one question at a time because of this. Not that they actually have an ephod to ask, but they created rules based on what they have seen and observed. Are the inhabitants of Keilah right in turning David and his men over to Saul? Are they right? Is it the right thing to do?
Well, it's not the right thing to do, in my opinion, but it's certainly ungrateful. Here David risked his life and the lives of his men to save them from the Philistines, which is the real enemy, and the thanks he gets is this. I don't know.
That's true. It does seem rather unfair. Yes, Carrie.
Saul just got done killing a bunch of priests and 85 people in a town because somebody helped David. So it sounds like the scared thing to do and maybe the safe thing to do.
See, that's a big dilemma they've got. They already know that Saul wiped out the town of Nob. It's common knowledge at this point. And they were a bunch of priests. Who are the citizens of Keilah? A bunch of Jews. A bunch of Judah. Men of Judah. What, are they anything valuable or of great significant importance? No. What's stopping Saul from wiping them out? Nothing. They have the same fear as the city of Nob because they saw what happened. They saw what Saul is capable of. They have a dilemma. All right, Saul. If Saul comes and asks, do they say, no, we're going to protect David and I'll die because Saul's done it before? Or do we say, okay, to preserve our skin, sorry, David, thank you, but we have our own wives, children, and to look after and hand you over. Does David fault them? No, he doesn't. He doesn't fault the citizens of Keilah. Now, he does the citizens of Ziph, which we'll get to later. But the citizens of Keilah, he does not fault. He says, okay, guys, let's get out of here. Because they didn't do anything right or wrong. They were just obeying what made sense for them, and with all the information they had. Saul had a history of killing people, his own people, godly people. So there's nothing to stop him from doing this. Now they did not, through their grace, capture David and hand him over. I'll give him some credit. They had some gratefulness. Hey David, just leave. Just leave. Just run away. Ziph, unfortunately, it didn't do such a thing. Which I think is funny because both cities are Judah. They're both the same tribe of David, but yeah. Their loyalties are mixed. So David leaves. He goes to the wilderness or area near Ziph. Again, his stopping ground, nearby where his hometown, his friends, and his men who are with him are accustomed to. He travels there, and of course, Yehonatan gives his last chance to see David. Not in the same fashion he did when he was saying goodbye to David, hugging and having friendship and, I'll miss you, blah, blah, blah. It's more of a, okay, David, you'll do okay, bye. It's a minister to him temporarily in order to get back. Why? Because Yehonatan would get in a lot of trouble if Saul found out. Because that means Yehonatan knows exactly where David is and won't do anything about it. Won't tell Saul, won't help him, won't help his father. Not a good position to be in if you're his son. So Yehonatan comes down. Of course, David is in the strongholds of Ziph. Let's see here. Where are we at here? Yehonatan, by the way, it is Yehonatan, not Yonatan. He's actually acting as a gift of God at this point in time. He says, fear not, for the hand of my father Saul will not find you. You will reign over Israel, and I will be your second. Of course, that doesn't actually happen, but he doesn't know that yet. My father Saul knows it. Your father Saul knows that you will be king. He knows it's going to happen. He doesn't like it, but he knows it. As far as they seal the covenant. Now, how many covenants did that make between David and Yehonatan? What was that? Three covenants. Yeah. One between the two of them. They would not battle one another. One was between Yehonatan's descendants and David's descendants. They wouldn't wipe each other's out. And this is the third one. What does this one add to the other two? Say it a little louder. Be king over Israel. It adds a little bit more than just that. But Jonathan would be second to him. They talked about this, but they didn't write a covenant about it. Now they wrote a covenant to make sure Jonathan would be second to him. Didn't happen. At least not at this point. Now, one could argue it still happens in our future with Elijah, but we won't discuss that. That's a different story. So he adds that, add to it that Jehonatan would be second to him, and of course he would in fact be the king of Israel. Now the men of Ziph. The men of Ziph have the same problem that Keilah has. They know David is around their territory. They know he's hanging around the city. His men probably come in to buy supplies. Do they obey Saul, the anointed one of God? Do they obey David, their kinsman? Well, same problem they've got. If they obey David, they're helping him. If Saul gets wind of it, Ziph is history. So what do they do? Well, if they did what David would have liked them to do, they'd have minded their own business. He talks about this in the Psalms. But instead, they had to rub their nose in it, jump right in, and volunteer. Hey, Saul, we'll catch him for you. They went up to Saul, of course, say, some of them, not the entire men, but some of the city, men of the city. Went up to Saul in Gibeah and said, David's hiding among us. However your soul desires, come down, and we will undertake to give him over into the hand of the king. And of course, Saul's, oh, wonderful, God's blessed me. God's blessed you all. The distinction between Keilah and Ziph is that Keilah at least allowed David and his men the opportunity to flee. Go ahead and run away. Go ahead and go. We won't do anything, just leave. In Ziph, they said, no, we're going to capture you and turn you over to Saul. They actually went a step further. David complains about Ziph later, which I believe the men of Ziph end up regretting it in a short time from now. David doesn't treat them very kindly in the future. So go to, of course, Saul says he's very cunning. I'll get through this a little bit faster because I want to get to Psalms pretty quick here. Saul comes down. Says, all right, first of all, I need witnesses. Verify where he's at. Saul comes down with all of his men. They go a little, skirmish. They don't actually fight. They're trying to find and capture him. David gets himself completely surrounded. And then Saul gets pulled away at the last minute. Saul's intention is to kill David? Well, yes, but not at this point. He wants to capture him first. Then he would kill him. David's not too pleased. But in Psalm 54, he writes a few things, as most songwriters do. At this point, David sees himself completely surrounded with the armies of Saul. There is no escape. Saul knows precisely where he's at. Knows where all the men are. He can't, escape. He can't hide. This is it. David knows he's history. Saul's men are far more numerous than David's, have much greater experience in killing. David's men would not be able to stand a chance. David has an option. He can either surrender now and preserve the life of as many men as he can, assuming that Saul preserves any of them, or fight and die. Two very unappealing prospects. Save me, O God, by your name, and vindicate me by your strength. Hear my prayer, O God. Give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers have risen up against me, and oppressors have sought after my life. They have not set God before them. Behold, God is my helper. The Lord is with those who uphold my life. He will repay my enemies for their evil and cut them off in your truth. I will freely sacrifice to you. I will praise your name, O Lord, for it is good. For he has delivered me out of all trouble, and my eye has seen its desire upon my enemies. So David's thoughts about this time when he is being surrounded by Saul. Notice what he does. He continues to praise God. Now does he say, God, I beg you of my life. They say, God, please kill Saul's men. Does he plead for God to to do something? Yeah, he does. Hear my prayer. That's the pleading. Everything else, he's just praising God. One of the things he does. The only thing he pleads for is, well, save me and hear my prayer. What does he have to say about the... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Rather than pleading, he's presenting his case.
Which he does periodically.
Yeah, because he says, they've risen up against me, and they've chased me, and they want to kill me. They have not set God before themselves.
Which is what I want to bring
God's my
question. God's
my helper. So he's pleading his case.
He is, and he pleads his case periodically with this. Not just this for a number of psalms. He pleads his case first. He goes through history and says, God, I've done XYZ, and you've done XYZ. I am not evil here. I haven't done anything wrong. Fix this. And of course, God usually does. What I want to point out here is that verse 3 says, for strangers are risen against me. The men of Ziph, they know David. Well, they know he's a biological relative. They know the men with him. Probably some of them. But not all the men of Ziph went against him. Only some of the men of Ziph. They are strangers to David. Strangers. They don't know me. They don't know anything about me. Yet they presume to go take sides. They know nothing. They're not helping anyone. They're just taking a side. None of their business to do so. He gets angry for them for doing that. That's not right. You don't know the situation. Keep your mouth shut. Go about your own business. That's all they need to do. But they didn't. They opened their mouths, they went up, they rose up against David without cause. David didn't do any harm to the men of Ziph, the territory of the land. He didn't do anything to them. But of course, they do it anyway. But I find it fascinating that David spends the entire time in this psalm, or the vast majority of it, saying how wonderful you are, God. I will sacrifice to you. I will praise you. I will bless your name because of what you've done. Yes, Anne.
How come he didn't go to the ephod and ask the Lord if he would get out of this situation?
Because I don't think he needed to. You see, when you ask the ephod, it's designed to give you, say, all right, God, I have a choice. I do X or I do Y. Which one am I supposed to do? How do I make these choices? At this point, David's men are completely surrounded. The choice is failure. And you can ask God, God, should I fail this way or should I fail that way? Well, what's the point? God, should I die this manner or should I die in that manner? What's the point? There's nothing to ask. Now, had David asked the men asked God before he went to Ziph, hey, are the men of Ziph going to conspire against me? Well, okay, that's a lot of foresight to be able to interpret what people are thinking beforehand, before you even get there. But he didn't do that. So David didn't have anything to ask him. The only thing he had left to do was say, God, you saved me before, save me again. And of course, God does. Now, a little question I've written up here. I spelled it out very clearly, those of you who can see it. It says, at what point do you stop and choose to disobey? At what point does something given to you, you must go do this, do you say, wait a minute, I have to stop and I have to disobey? It's a fundamental question. We all run across it. I mentioned earlier, it's a point which we run across it periodically. I know that doing this route over here is right. I also know doing this route over here is right. But I have to break one of them to do the other. So David asks this and points this out. And says, they have not set God before them in verse 3. These strangers. They have set what their law says they must do. But the law and God are not the same thing. David knows that. The law is what is written down. He must do. But God, as in case those who have not noticed, periodically makes his people disobey the law all the time. Human feces sound familiar? You know, marrying a harlot, does that sound familiar? He commands you to disobey his own laws. He does it periodically. Yes, Anne.
Is this the same in some way, like that declaration, the Manhattan Declaration that they made? I mean, that they have they set God, how does it say, the strangers are our government, and they've set up themselves against God and not set God before them, and so now we are going to say yes, we're going to say yes to God and no to you if this continues?
Depending on your personal perspective, mine is yes. That's what they've done. Now, whether they should have, I don't really care. That's what they've done. Now, is there a better way of doing it? There might be. But I wasn't part of it. That's just what they've done, to the best of their ability and their knowledge. There might be some other solution. Maybe some other way of doing it. It doesn't matter. That's what they've done. They've chosen, to the best of their ability, to select, all right, this is the path that I am supposed to follow. As far as my leadership that God has put in place tells me to do, I am making an open declaration that if you force me down this path, I will not go. That is a fundamental question. Now, for them and the people who wrote that or who signed this Manhattan Declaration org thing, that's what they have chosen to do. Is there a better way? Maybe. I don't know. And I don't really care. That's what they've chosen to do, what these men have chosen to do. Yes.
Well, same thing with Peter and Paul.
It is the same thing.
They chose to disobey.
They chose to disobey. The law states quite clearly what they were allowed and not allowed to do, in particular with obeying the Sanhedrin, or obeying the people who were in charge. And God came and told them both, specifically, you will not.
Peter, he's unclean.
Yeah, Peter.
Did he obey or disobey?
Yeah, he was unclean. Yes, Ellie.
The unspoken issue at hand is, I choose to disobey and die.
Right.
That's not said, but that's the point.
That is the point. Because in Kalah's position, had they chosen to disobey Saul, they would be dead. Ziph's position, had they chosen to disobey Saul, once Saul found out about it, they would probably be dead.
I'm right and dead, or I'm wrong and possibly dead anyway.
Possibly dead anyway. Right. Nothing to gain or to lose. In Abiathar's father, Ahimelech, was he given the option of choosing to disobey? Not really. Why? Because David didn't give it to him. David didn't tell Ahimelech, hey, this is what's going on. This is what has happened in my life, what Samuel has done to me and where I am at and where I'm going. To give Ahimelech the option of saying, I would know what the law says, but I will either choose to obey or disobey at the option or the loss of my own life. Hence, David takes full responsibility for that one, but doesn't take responsibility for anything else Saul does. It's a point at which you choose. The point at which you say, all right, I know this path, I've seen it before, and I'm not supposed to follow that in spite of what I'm being told. I have to say no, no matter what the consequence is. The men of Ziph, the men of Keilah, David's own men, David himself, make that decision periodically, over and over and over and over and over again. It's David's choice, as he pointed out, strangers, you're strangers. Keep your mouth shut, mind your own business. It doesn't affect you. But when it does, that's when decisions have to be made. Any comments or questions? Yes, Anne.
About the strangers, though. Okay, so they came for the Jew first. That, well, I'm not Jewish, and then they came for the Catholic. Well, I wasn't Catholic, and you know the rest of that story. And then they came for me. I mean,
and there was no one left. You see, that's an interesting point, because at that point, you have to decide: are you in fact a stranger? In some ways, you're okay, in this world, stranger and pilgrim. But on issues of when something is happening against a man of God or a people of God, if you call yourself part of God and you throw your hat into the ring with everybody else, and we're all going to follow God, or in case you're Jewish, you throw your bagel in the ring, what is the point at which you say, all right, anybody in this ring that gets penalized, I'm going to fight for them also? You have to make the choice still. I made mine. My bagel's in the ring. Well, I'm not really Jewish. I'm whatever my thing is. My hat, whatever it is. My kippah, my shoe, whatever. It's already in the ring. So if anybody else in that ring gets injured, hurt, or harmed, what's my job? Go defend them, because I'm not a stranger to them. Now, if I'm not in the ring, and between David and Saul, the men of Ziph were not in the ring. This is an internal battle of a family. This is an internal thing. David and Saul, the men of Ziph were separate. They didn't have to go and throw their hat in on either side. They could have left it out. Because David said, you are strangers. You do not know me. You don't know why you were chosen one path versus the other. You just arbitrarily chose. Had the men of Ziph come to David and said, hey, Saul's after you, explain this to me, would they still be strangers? Well, no. Now they have intimate knowledge. Now they can make an informed decision. So David has issues with that. When you go and jump into the ring and jump on one side without knowing why you're arbitrarily choosing to do so, that's not a righteous choice. That's not a godly act. That's not putting God in front of you. That's putting your own desires in front of you.
Stupid
decision. I need to call it quits. Go ahead, Ellie.
Since David is playing the part of the Messiah, or God says he's a man after my own heart, then in a sense you're saying the Messiah is saying, hey, look, there's times to sit tight, stay out of it, and then there's times to throw your kippah or whatever into the ring, because this is going to be a fight to the end, and we'll see.
We're getting our hands dirty. Yeah.
See who God has standing at the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it the time to fight, time to peace, the time for all? I forgot the war, all the various other things. I forgot the entire process. Time for everything. Ecclesiastes, I don't recall which chapter or verse, but it's in there.